From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly radio show produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. On today's broadcast, we share the work of two other radio programs, something we like to do from time to time here on the show. In the first half of the episode, a June 2008 broadcast of the show Making Contact, produced in Oakland, California by the National Radio Project. The segment features a lecture from author Raj Patel of the recently released book Stuffed and Starved. And in the second half of the episode, two segments from the weekly show Red Eye, produced at Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia. The segments explore the concept of food sovereignty with the University of Regina's Annette Desmarais, and a look into the precarious state of the Canadian Wheat Board with journalist Francis Russell.
With food riots taking place all over the world and prices continuing to rise, more people are asking, why in a world with so many resources is our most basic need so hard to meet?
Although we feel like our food is made for us, and you get a Burger King, you have it your way. In fact, we are being made for our food.
On this program, we'll hear Raj Patel speak about his new book, Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. I'm Andrew Stelzer, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Raj Patel used to work for the World Bank, the WTO, and the United Nations. Now, as an author and activist, Patel has become a harsh critic of the way those organizations set policy that leads to increasing hunger and food insecurity around the world. Patel spoke at Cody's Books in Berkeley, California, in May of 2008.
The story I want to tell is a story about Stuffed and Starved, about why it is that we live in a world where there are 850 million people who go hungry every year and a billion people who are overweight. And the argument I want to make will take us through a range of places. It will take us from India to South Africa to the United States to Brazil. And in fact, let's start with Brazil, because I think Brazil is the venue for what I think is wrong about the way our food comes to us today. The way our food comes to us is through markets. And the result of markets is markets can turn wonderful things into disasters. And I want to start with my audiovisual device here. If you look on the back of this Snickers bar, you'll find, I mean, it's like a long mystery, a strange concatenation of things that we don't know what they are. It starts off with something that looks fairly straightforward, milk chocolate. But the chocolate in here is actually mysterious to us. We don't know where it comes from. If it comes from the Ivory Coast, and a great deal of the world's chocolate does come from the Ivory Coast, then there is a small but significant chance that it was grown using child slavery. Now, actually, the ingredient that I'd like to dwell on a little bit more is one that comes a little further down the list, called lecithin. It's there primarily as an emulsifier. It is there to keep the water and the fat from separating out, so that this bar can remain on the shelf for an eternity without going rancid. The lecithin comes from an ingredient that we eat every day. It is in three quarters of everything that's processed foods in the supermarket, and in almost everything that the fast food industry sells us. And that ingredient is soy. Now, soy is, for me, a fine example of what happens when markets run riot, and how markets are able to turn something wonderful into something quite awful. Everything from vegetable oil to the ink in our newspapers comes from soy. And one of the first enthusiasts for the industrial production of soy was also the godfather of modern capitalism. That man was Henry Ford. Henry Ford was big into soy. He held a party in 1935 in his Dearborn, Michigan plant. And he came down the marble staircase, and he was wearing this sort of wonderful, sort of soft, downy suit. And when he reached the bottom, he said to his assembled guests, "Stroke my suit." And they stroked his suit, and it was as soft as down. They were very impressed. And then he said, "And this suit is made entirely out of soy." And they were very impressed. Now, that's obviously a very sort of frivolous example of what soy was for. But actually, Henry Ford wanted, ultimately, to be able to grow entire cars out of soy. And if this sounds a little mad, bear in mind that by the end of the 1930s, there were 2 bushels of soy in every Ford motor car. And they were used for fiber, for pigment. They even tried to use it on the inside of the car as a lacquer. But they had to stop that because it smelled like a mortuary. Suffice it to say that Henry Ford's production techniques and his production technologies have certainly been applied to soy with vigor. And the soy in this bar, if it doesn't come from the United States, will come from Brazil, the world's largest soy exporter. And if it comes from Brazil, then it is part of a process of great environmental damage. Soy farms are now encroaching into the Cerrado and into the Amazonian rainforest. You know, we were hearing about McDonald's unleashing cows on the Amazon. Well, it's not cows, it's soy. And the process of environmental destruction isn't just related to sort of clear cutting. The water underneath Brazil comes from, in part, from one of the world's largest aquifers, which is being drained dry. And it is on soy plantations, as well as biofuels plantations, we can talk about that, but on soy plantations, that Brazil's 40,000 agricultural slaves live today. Now, all this, again, so that the price of soy gets pushed down just a little bit and this bar stays intact for just a little bit longer. So who wins from that? We might think it's farmers who are reaping the rewards of, you know, low labor costs and environmental damage. But actually, well, we have an intuition that helps us understand who wins from, you know, the way we grow food today. Think about oil. When the price of oil goes up, who do we think makes money? It's not oil workers, people who are drilling for oil, who suddenly find themselves with, you know, dollars falling out of their pockets and driving around in Bentleys. By the same token, it is not the people on gas station forecourts who are suddenly making millions of dollars. We understand when the price of oil goes up, the people who profit are the oil industry and the financiers who surround them. Well, it's kind of the same way with food. If you look at any market, any major commodity market in food, basically more than half of that market is controlled by just 4 or 5 corporations. In the global market in tea, one corporation, Unilever, controls 90% of the world market. Now, that's an extreme case, but basically, you know, there are in every sector just a few corporate giants. I wanted to relay to you a quote that explains what these companies think about us, their consumers. Because, you know, I mean, a lot of the justification for having corporations come to, you know, to provide us our food rests in the idea that somehow corporations compete against each other and drive down the price of food, and the winner is the consumer, and, you know, 2 big thumbs up, everything's fine. So here's a quote from a man who, when he said this, was chair of Archer Daniels Midland. This was a Mother Jones interview a few years ago. He has this to say about competition and the free market. The customer is our enemy, and the competitor is our friend. There is not one grain of anything in the world that is sold in a free market. Not one. The only place that you see free markets are in the speeches of politicians. And people who are not from the Midwest do not realize that this is a socialist country. And I think that sort of brazen honesty from Dwayne Andreas shouldn't surprise us. We shouldn't be surprised that corporations make a buck. That's kind of what they do. They are in it for profit. And if profit can be made through the skirting of certain kinds of rules and the flouting of certain kinds of regulations, so be it. The interesting question, though, is not why corporations are rapacious, because that's a trivial question. The interesting question is, why do we have markets in food at all? And markets in food are very odd. They're very new. The world's first completed market in food, global market in food, was the global market in wheat. And that was really only complete by 1880. They're very, very new things, these global markets. But it's important to understand how they came about and why, and the kind of rationale that accompanied them. And the interesting place to look here is India. I mean, let's sort of go back in time to sort of feudal India, in India before the British arrived. And feudal India was rubbish for peasants, because peasants worked the landlords took the surplus and left the peasants with barely enough to survive on. The only silver lining being that in a rough year, when food was scarce, it was the landlord's obligation to feed the peasants. there was this moral economy that persisted, this idea that people wouldn't be allowed to go hungry. They wouldn't be allowed to actually, you know, get fat, but they certainly wouldn't be allowed to go hungry in lean times. So there were responsibilities that came with that. When the British came, they thought that this was pathetically backward and that Indians shouldn't be wanting a hand out so much as a hand up. The language of compassionate conservatism today actually hails from these moments where the British were imposing markets in grain with this rhetoric of, well, it'll increase your productivity and it's much better to work for yourself than to rely on the handout of some landlord who's just a tosser. This process of imposing markets was, you know, to some extent, deeply felt as a good thing by the British who were doing it. They felt that they were improving Indians. And they were certainly doing a favour for the British because these markets worked very well for people who had cash. It worked for the British to be able to suck grain out of India and send it to England, where it was eaten by workers in the workshop of the world. It worked well for the British. But trouble with introducing markets in food is that if you don't have cash, you don't get to eat. And so what you had was a sort of situation where people were loading wheat in Bombay. They were loading wheat onto the ships that were then sailing off to England. And then they were dying on the docks because they couldn't afford to buy food. And there's no figure that really describes the imposition of markets more starkly than a figure from Mike Davis's excellent book, Late Victorian Holocausts. The figure he gives is this. In the 2,000 years before the British came to India, there was a famine once every 120 years. But in the period after the British came to India, there was a famine once every 4 years. So from once every 120 to once every 4 years, because of the imposition of markets in food. It's certainly the case that what was true for India was true for the rest of the world. In this imposition of markets in grain, over 30 million people died, just so they could learn the most brutal and vicious microeconomics lesson in history, which is that the only way to get food is to pay for it. Now, let's sort of move forward a bit. I don't want to dwell on India, but I think it's an important case. And in fact, the importance of it was driven home to me when I was living in South Africa, because when I was growing up, my parents used to say to me, "Eat up. There are children starving in Africa. Eat your greens, for God's sake." Now, what do you think that parents in Africa tell their children? Seriously. Well, they say eat up because there are children starving in India, and they are more right. There are more children starving in India than they are in the entire continent of Africa. And India today is, to me, an example of what happens when markets go wild. Now, certainly, you know, the real losers in this sort of story of global food production are farmers. And one of the hardest, in fact, the hardest part of writing Stuffed and Starved was talking to families of farmers who had despaired. Let me give you the story of India, because I mean, certainly in the American imagination, India is the place where all the jobs have gone. If you go to Bangalore, you'll see these glittering towers of modern capitalism. You'll see your Google and your Infosys and your Intel and Microsoft and what have you. But 5 hours out, there's a very different story. The story I want to tell you is about a farmer called Kistaya. Like any farmer, I mean, he was farming, what, half an acre. He had a wife, two kids, and he wanted to leave his kids something better than he had, like any parent. And so he borrowed money from the only place he could, the local moneylender. Borrowed money and he drilled a hole because he wanted to be able to irrigate his land. He drilled a borehole for a well, but the well was dry. And that meant that he not only needed to increase the productivity just for his kids, but he needed to repay the loan in a hurry. So he borrowed more money and he drilled another hole and it was dry. And he borrowed more money, he drilled another hole and it too was dry. And he borrowed more money and he drilled another hole and it was dry again. And one day, when the rains refused to come, he despaired. That evening, after his wife and kids had gone to bed, he pulled down a packet of pesticide called 4-8, which is illegal in the United States but sold by U.S. companies in the developing world. He mixed it with water and he drank it. And it would have been an agonizing death. His nerves would have jammed, he would have asphyxiated. But he can't have convulsed very hard because he died without waking his wife and two kids. And all this because he faced a debt of 15,000 rupees, or $350. Now, that's horrifying in and of itself. It's more horrifying when you know that there are tens of thousands of farmer suicides in India every year. But it's not just an Indian phenomenon. Sustainable, sort of small-scale farmers around the world are in deep trouble wherever you look. They've borrowed up to their eyeballs just to be able to keep their heads above water. And then all it takes is one small shock. Maybe the rains don't come. Or, as we see in Australia, maybe there's a drought and the crops fail. And we've seen farmer suicides in Australia as a result. Or maybe foot and mouth disease breaks out and your entire herd is killed by the government, as we saw in Britain. And in that case, farmers have committed suicide there too. And of course, farmer suicides started here. They started in the US, in the Midwest, in the 1980s with the farm crisis. And it spread around the world, and it began here for reasons of debt and fear and shame. Because no farmer wants to be the person who is remembered as the one who lost the land.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. We now return to Raj Patel, speaking about his new book, Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System.
This is in the same India that has now more billionaires than any other in the Forbes top 10 billionaires list. And at the same time, India's hungriest people are seeing levels of hunger that haven't been seen since the British left. And at the same time, India is now the world's largest concentration of people with type 2 diabetes. How is it possible that all these things could be happening at the same time? And a lot of the story has to do with the guy who is now Prime Minister of India, a guy called Manmohan Singh, who in 1990 instituted kind of trade liberalisation, economic liberalisation in general. And that liberalisation meant that companies were allowed into India, companies that had been kept out, you know, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, these sorts of companies. They were invited in, and at the same time, social supports for farmers in particular started being eroded. The government was delinquent in its payments. It shrunk the social safety net for the very hungriest people. It denied access to local grain stores if you didn't have a fixed address. I mean, a shrinking of the entitlement body of the Indian government and the Indian state, and at the same time, the sort of bracing liberalisation where farmers would be exposed more or less to the winds of free competition. And that has been, you know, that has resulted in extreme kinds of polarization of income and of life outcomes. And again, it's not just India that is going through this. It's a global phenomenon. And it's one that is imposed in various ways by one of my previous employers, the World Bank. It is important to have in your mind an image of how the World Bank works, because sometimes it can seem a little complicated, you know, concessional loans and, you know, structural adjustment policies and, you know, poverty reduction strategy credits, blah, blah, blah. But actually, there's an image that I would very much like you to have in mind. And it comes from the Terry Gilliam film, Time Bandits. Has anyone seen Time Bandits? A couple of people seen Time Bandits? It is about disgruntled former employees of God. The idea is the universe was built in 7 days. So it was a rush job. And there are holes. There are holes in the universe. And the time bandits jump through, you know, they rob people and they jump through time. They end up somewhere else. So they rob Napoleon and they jump through a hole in time and they end up in Sherwood Forest, where they are met by Robin Hood. And he's tremendously excited to see all Napoleon's stuff. And this is tremendous. Well, thank you very much indeed. The poor will love this. Have you met the poor? Charming people, they don't have two pennies to rub together, but that's because they're poor. And there's this beautiful scene where Hood is distributing, you know, the gold and the diamonds and, you know, sort of bringing on the poor here. And, oh, here they come. And he sort of walks down, he shakes their hand. And then right next to him, there's a bloke who takes back whatever Hood has given and punches the person in the face. And that's how the World Bank works. But because it is, I mean, it's certainly about the sort of, have you met the poor? Some of my best friends are poor. And I would know, I was involved in a project called The Voices of the Poor. Can anyone hear us? I mean, there's certainly the sort of moment of representation and misrepresentation of the bank as friend of the poor. And at the same time, the giving of the loan feels like it's a gift. But it's always a gift that you take back and you slam in the face with these conditions, these structural adjustment conditions, which require farmers in developing countries to sit on the same playing field as the most heavily subsidized farmers on the planet, like here and in Europe. It's preposterous to think that farmers in developing countries could in any way compete against the multi-billion dollar subsidies that we see here. And this is why World Bank policy is effectively geared towards kicking farmers off the land, particularly small and sustainable farmers. So that's kind of the sort of state of play at the moment. But I think what we need to do is get to thinking about what we can do about it. How are we going to change this? How are we going to fix it? One of the temptations is to go down to your local supermarket, to your Whole Foods. You'll go in and you'll look for something that is, you know, shade-grown and organic and fair trade and, you know, beetle-friendly. And I mean, the trouble is, the moment you step into a supermarket, you are in the belly of the new giants of the food system. The moment you step into a supermarket, you surrender a great deal of freedom. Everything about a supermarket is engineered. Everything. I mean, the smell in the air. I mean, why is it that supermarkets have bakeries in them? Not because supermarkets are making billions from buns. It is because the smell of baking bread makes us buy more stuff. And why is it that the milk is always at the back? Because it is the single item that we are in supermarkets most often to buy. And so there's sort of golden triangle between the entrance and the milk and the checkout, where corporations bid to have their products facing you at eye level, or, you know, at cart level if they're going for your kids. You go into the supermarket for milk and you find yourself coming out with a ton of other stuff that you never expected to buy, that you didn't choose necessarily. You didn't choose to buy that when you went in, but you chose it as you walked past. And you call it choice when you're being manipulated into buying something. We're taught to call that choice. In a sense, it's madness to expect supermarkets to provide us, you know, the answers to these kinds of social problems. And in fact, you know, it is the supermarket that these days is kind of the embodiment of how we are linked to the exploitation of farmers in developing countries. We are being manipulated by exactly the same system. And the solution, as I'll be suggesting in a minute, is not to feel guilty about our food choices, not to be paralyzed into thinking, oh, gee, you know, I can't eat this, I can't eat this, sod it, I'm going to have a steak. That gets you nowhere. Guilt is tremendously debilitating. And I think, you know, what we need is not guilt, but anger. Anger at the way that we are being manipulated and that we are made complicit in a food system that denies justice to people across the world, and even in the supermarket. I mean, Walmart's workers have been denied rest breaks to the extent that some have been forced to urinate at the tills. And yet, of course, we find ourselves going into supermarkets because it's convenient, because it fits our lifestyle. And this is one of the last stories I want to tell you. I think it's important to get under the skin of this idea of convenience. And the story I want to tell you comes from South Africa. The story is about the foundational moments of apartheid. When apartheid was being built, it required laws. One of those laws was the 1947 Regulation of Separate Amenities Act. What that law entailed was that white people and black people were no longer allowed to use the same cooking facilities, no longer allowed to use the same plates or cutlery or knives or forks or anything. And this was a problem for black caddies on a white golf course in Durban. And they came up with one of Durban's signature foods. It's called bunny chow. Now, bunny chow is a loaf of white bread with the inside scooped out, and it's filled with curry. And so the idea is that, you know, you run to the bunny chow guy, you go from the golf course to the bunny chow guy, get your loaf of bread. He fills it with curry. And then all of a sudden the clock starts ticking because, you know, the curry's seeping into the bread. And so you've got to eat quickly. You've got to take the edge of the bread, you dip it in the curry, and you chew. And you take, you dip, you chew. Until there's nothing left. The bread was your cutlery. You've finished eating, and it's all done. So it's in entire compliance with the Regulation of Separate Amenities Act. Boy, I think the important lesson here is that it was one of the world's first government-sponsored fast foods. Because there's nothing convenient about a loaf of white bread with curry in it. I mean, it's a preposterous idea. And yet it becomes convenient because of the regulation of our working lives and the laws that are imposed to govern and separate the way that we work and live. And all of a sudden, the maddest things become convenient. Another preposterous idea is Diet Coke Plus. If you come across that, it's Diet Coke with added vitamins. This is what you get when you ask corporations to improve the nutritional quality of their food. And it's like, well, we'll throw in some vitamins. We get what? Vitamins, even. I think, you know, we need to be taking a step back from asking corporations to do our politics for us. And we need to be connecting more with our food. And an organization that does this, and I get a great deal of inspiration from them, as I'm sure you do too, is the Italian Communist Party. They asked a really interesting question in the 1970s. And they were reacting to sort of capitalism and a sort of austere Euro-communism, and they were asking, why is it that only rich people get to have sensuousness and pleasure from their food? Why is that not the right of every human being? And so the organization that the Italian communists started was an organization that was called Slow Food. The original sort of Slow Food was asking some great questions. What is it that you need to do in order to be able to make sure that everyone can savor food and enjoy food? What is it that people need? You need two things. You need time and money. Is it any wonder that 20% of American fast food meals are eaten in cars because they are convenient? And people will choose between Burger King and McDonald's, but that's no choice. Although we feel like our food is made for us, and you go to Burger King, you have it your way. In fact, we are being made for our food. We are being transformed in the ways that our lives are regulated, in the way that our society is regulated, towards demanding and thinking as normal the most preposterous kinds of food. There are ways of challenging that. And all the ideas that I've been sharing with you today have basically come from Via Campesina, the international peasant movement, which by some estimates have over 150 million members. What they're suggesting is actually what we need is a democratic conversation about food. Not to turn the clock back to some fairy tale past, but to move forward to a future where people have rights, where land is distributed equitably, agriculture is sustainable, and where communities get to decide how food comes in and out of that community. This isn't about sort of every community must produce its own thing. It's about every community must have the conversation, or at least be able to have the conversation, about how food enters and circulates within the community. We need to learn how to do that. Food policy councils are one way of doing it, direct action another. There are an infinite number of ways to have that democratic conversation. But we've got to develop a taste for it, and we are being de-skilled in that art. The preposterous example that comes to mind is Mountain Dew. I don't know if you've seen Mountain Dew have a thing where you get to choose which of three new flavors of Mountain Dew will be your flavor at the end of the summer. And you get to choose between Mountain Dew Voltage and Mountain Dew Supernova and Mountain Dew Revolution. What do they call this? They call it Dewmocracy. That's the kind, but if we have sort of Coke or Pepsi in the supermarkets, we also have Coke or Pepsi in the ballot box. And if that's our experience of democracy, then actually we're used to a very candid and reduced version of democracy. In fact, it's not democracy at all. It's its poor cousin, consumer choice. But I think we do need to get involved in democracy. We do need to get involved in the kinds of activist politics. We won't be able to shop our way out of this one, and we shouldn't. And we should get angry and politically engaged, because we need to realize that we are not consumers of democracy. We are its proprietors. Thanks very much.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to Raj Patel, a former policy analyst for Food First, speaking about his new book, Stuffed and Starved. Patel spoke at Cody's Books in Berkeley, California in May of 2008. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Tina Rubio, executive producer, Puck Lowe, associate producer, Elena Botkin-Levy and Aubrey Green, interns, and I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly radio show produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. A thank you to Making Contact for producing that last segment. In the next half of today's broadcast, we listen in on two segments produced by Red Eye at Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO. In January 2009, Red Eye's Lorraine Chisholm spoke with the University of Regina's Annette Desmarais, a professor of justice studies and the author of La Via Campesina, Globalization and the Power of Peasants. La Via Campesina is a grassroots organization that promotes the concept of food sovereignty.
This year, for the first time in human history, a billion people will go hungry. As prices for basic grain skyrocketed last year, millions of people were unable to purchase sufficient food. Riots and protests erupted all over the world. These dramatic headlines have faded, but the crisis remains. La Via Campesina, a global movement of peasant farmers, believes that the latest food crisis has exposed the disaster of the global food system. And they have a solution that they believe will feed the world and cool the planet. It's called food sovereignty. Annette Demaret has worked as a technical support for La Via Campesina since the movement emerged in 1993. She's a professor in the Department of Justice Studies at the University of Regina, and she joins us from there this morning. Annette, hello.
Hello.
La Via Campesina held its latest international conference last October, and I understand there was a lot of discussion about the food crisis and its root causes. What were people discussing around the root causes of that? Why are so many people going hungry?
Well, La Via Campesina essentially argues that there are some really long-term causes to this food crisis and also some, you know, much more kind of shorter-term causes. And the long-term causes, I mean, they had actually pointed to these some years ago, in the early 1990s, actually. And it was partly because they had had experience with the structural adjustment programs that had been implemented in a number of countries. And those structural adjustment programs, which were really based on a neoliberal ideology, fundamentally altered the rural landscape and also, of course, disempowered small farmers in their ability to make a living on the land. And what I mean about when I say structural adjustment, it actually was turned agriculture into kind of a structurally adjusted kind of agriculture, where food was treated just like any other commodity, and therefore was placed on the free trade agenda. And so, in the year before the WTO opened its door, the Via Campesina was formed, and it did that. It formed this international movement because they knew that putting food on the free trade agenda was going to spell disaster for small producers and also for the health of a food system. Because what it meant was that governments then would start concentrating on increasing production and increasing that production specifically for export. That was done at the expense of production for domestic consumption. So in the process, what you had then were fields, you know, acres and acres and acres that were normally planted to food for national production, for domestic consumption. Those were replaced by acres and acres of broccoli, snow peas, mangoes, flowers for northern markets. And consequently, countries that used to be self-sufficient in certain basic grains were then becoming net importers of food.
Tell me how the organization La Via Campesina developed an alternative model. Did that emerge from what was traditionally in place, or was there another approach?
Oh, well, their analysis demonstrated that not only was this process of, you know, structurally adjusted agriculture taking place, but that the policies of the international institutions like the World Bank and the IMF and also national governments were in fact encouraging the globalization of an industrial model of agriculture. And that's the production system which very effectively distances production from consumption, so consumers have no idea what it is that they're eating. And they have no idea about how that food is produced and who produces it and the conditions under which it is produced. And, it essentially leaves us with a food system in which food crops kind of disappear overnight from fields and then they're kind of deconstructed and then reconstructed by a number of industrial processes. And then they appear on the shelves of supermarkets in kind of really brightly colored packages with a tag that says may contain. Okay? And that was the model that was being globalized. And so farmers, in this system, farmers are completely displaced. It is a model that gives far more strength to industrial players, because what those industrial players do is essentially enter the food system and lengthen the food chain and try to extract profits along every link of the chain. In that process, farmers are pushed, are fundamentally marginalized. because what the industrial players want to do is access whatever raw products they need at the lowest price possible. So La Via Campesina, sought to turn this model completely around, which it did by developing this concept of food sovereignty.
So tell me more then about the concept of food sovereignty. What's meant by that?
Well, can I just say one more thing about the causes? Because
yes.
I was just talking about the long-term causes, but the short-term causes, of course, were the fact that you had the entry of speculators into food markets. You know, with the housing mortgage crisis in the USA, what happened was speculators, hedge funds, moved their investments away from real estate and placed it into the futures markets for commodities like grains and other food products. Okay, and the other main kind of shorter term cause was the fact that you have this agro-fuel boom where fields that used to be planted to grains for people, we're now producing grains to make ethanol, essentially to feed machines. So that was creating an artificial scarcity, which helped, of course, to increase the price of food. Okay, now to your question of what is food sovereignty all about? Well, it completely rejects this neoliberal idea of, the right to export. Essentially, it seeks to radically transform food production, food distribution, and food consumption. It's central to the idea of food sovereignty is the idea that peoples have the right to determine their own agricultural and food policies, and to do so in a way that ensures the well-being of their populations. So it's not only about governments defining agricultural policy. It's about ordinary citizens, people who both produce and consume food, being involved in determining all kinds of issues around the production, the distribution, and the consumption of food. So essentially, it focuses. It's got a number of kind of key principles, and one of them is that it focuses on producing food for people instead of food for animals. Food for animals that are produced in intensive livestock operations, that kind of thing, or instead of producing food for machines. Okay, the second key principle is that it really focuses on closing the gap between food producers and food consumers. The third key principle is that it puts those who produce and consume food at the center of decision making on agricultural and food policies. And that's instead of giving over decision making powers to kind of faraway institutions like the World Trade Organization, who really do not experience the consequences of their decisions. Food sovereignty localizes that decision making, therefore making everyone more responsible, more accountable for the decisions that they make. Now that can be done through the creation of policy councils, other kinds of local governance structures that determine how communities will grow and access food.
Annette, what kind of changes would have to take place for food sovereignty to be achieved?
Fundamental transformation.
Yeah, we're talking about the world food system.
In the way that we think about food. In the place that we give food in our cultures. It really speaks to some fundamental shifts in how we think and how we are around food. I think in Canada, food in many ways has become less and less important as an expression of culture, for example. And that would need to change. I mean, you know, food is at the center of our lives. You know, food is not only central because we eat it daily, we absolutely need it, but because to produce food, we're talking about the environment. We're also talking about how it can be central to our culture and to also social relations. And I think that's what's so exciting. The other exciting thing about food sovereignty is that it's going to be different in different places. There's not, you know, it's not a, because it empowers local people to make decisions about how that food is produced, where it's produced, and what is produced, and at what scale, then that means that it's going to be different in different places based on the kinds of cultures that people want to promote or to build. So it is, you know, central to food sovereignty is this idea of diversity. Also, it's not something that you can is going to be the same in Java as it is in Canada.
What do you think that people could do? So if people are listening to you and they're kind of making the connection that there has to be a big shift in their thinking around food as consumers of foods, what steps could they make to change their relationship to the food that they eat, which you describe as so important and central?
Well, I think the further away you can get from eating industrial food, the closer you're going to be to achieving food sovereignty. That is, you know, you should know what it is that you're putting in your mouth. And, you know, right now, if somebody, you know, is eating Captain Crunch for breakfast, they're not going to really know what's in that Captain Crunch. And it's a highly, you know, it's, I mean, there's a new study that just came out this week about the high levels of mercury that have been discovered in products that are made by with high fructose corn syrup. And high fructose syrup, corn syrup, is found in virtually, you know, in an awful lot of processed foods. So, so one of the things that you want to do is move away from foods that you don't know what it contains. Okay. The other thing that you want to do is make sure that you know who produced the food. So farmers markets, community shared agriculture, are two ways that you can, you know, that are relatively easy shifts to make, and that actually would allow you to be involved in some aspects of food sovereignty. The other key way to start working, to start building food sovereignty, is to work at trying to build a local governance structure, like a food policy council. I mean, I'm just using that as an example. It can be something else, you know, but something that allows you to get involved in a discussion of what kinds of policies, you know, should municipal governments and provincial governments and national governments be putting in place to foster food sovereignty, rather than, you know, some of the existing policies that we have, which are so destructive, because the thing about the food crisis is that it's not only a food crisis. It's you know, we're in a part of the history of the world where at a point in the history of the world where we're faced with an environmental crisis, an energy crisis, and a food crisis, and so somehow you know, food sovereignty can help us to resolve various aspects of those various crises.
Well, it's been great talking to you this morning, Annette. I really appreciate your joining me.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Annette Demaret. Annette is the author of La Via Campesina, Globalization and the Power of Peasants, published last year.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. More information on Annette Demaret will be linked to from the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the August 13th, 2009 episode. Taking us to the end of today's broadcast, another segment produced by Vancouver Co-op Radio's Red Eye. In this segment, Red Eye's Mordechai Brimberg speaks with journalist Francis Russell, a regular contributor to the Winnipeg Free Press. Russell writes extensively about the Canadian Wheat Board, an organization that has been at the forefront of controversy in the past few years. The Wheat Board is controlled by Western Canadian farmers and is the largest wheat and barley marketer in the world. The Wheat Board sells grain to over 70 countries and returns all revenues, less marketing costs, directly to prairie farmers. The only problem, in its efforts to ensure farmers receive a fair price for their product, the Wheat Board is frowned upon by anyone who believes in the global market of so-called free trade. The Canadian government, who exists at an arm's length from the Wheat Board, is one of those entities wishing for the Wheat Board to disappear.
The Canadian Wheat Board was established in 1935 as a marketing system for wheat and barley. And while the Canadian Wheat Board has undergone several changes over the years to meet economic and political pressures, now it is under the severest attack by the Harper government. On the phone from Winnipeg in Manitoba is freelance writer Frances Russell. She's been reporting on the struggles around the Canadian Wheat Board, and we're happy to welcome her to our program this morning. Good morning, Frances.
Good morning.
Now, is Harper's opposition to the Wheat Board longstanding, or is this something since he's come into government?
Oh, it's quite long-standing. In fact, when he was, you may remember that after he left politics the first time, he became president of the National Citizens Coalition, which is arguably the most right-wing lobby in Canada. And in 1999, he wrote a letter to the Brandon Sun in which he described the Wheat Board as a, quote, draconian wheat monopoly that for years has relied on force and fear to exist, end of quote. And there's been reports that he's also compared it to the Soviet Union, and which, by the way, the NCC used to say Medicare was just a Soviet plot.
Well, this is Cold War rhetoric, which has a revival presently in the world. But is his effort to totally destroy the Wheat Board?
Yes, although of course, you know, they cloak it in the word of choice, you know, because they have several very small farmer organizations, the Western Canadian Wheat Growers Association, the Western Canadian Barley Growers Association, that really got their funding primarily and maybe still do from the Alberta government. They say, no, we don't want to do away with the Wheat Board. We just want the right to be able to use it when we want to and not use it when we don't want to. And of course, anybody who knows anything about the principles of cooperatives and pools know that you can't have that kind of a system because it completely breaks down almost immediately. And in the case of the Wheat Board, because it does not, it purchases services. It's a marketing agency in which all Western Canadian farmers pool. You know, there's about 85,000 of them, by the way. That if you know it doesn't have terminals, it doesn't have has hopper cars. Actually, they were the federal government's. So it has to rely on everybody. You know, it's all for one and one for all.
Who would benefit if Harper were successful?
Oh well, absolutely no question. The five big agribusiness multinationals, most of them situated in the United States, Archer Daniels, Midland, Bungie, Cargill, Louis Dreyfus, these are the organizations that would benefit exclusively, and of course so would indirectly the American government, because what it would mean would be that instead of Canada being in a position to market Canadian grain, which is very vastly superior, by the way, to American grain because of our colder climate, our durum and wheat are highly prized on the world market and fetch top dollar. So if they could blend that into their own inferior quality grain, they would be able to get the benefit of top dollar for American farmers and for these multinationals.
What are the tactics that Harper has used to try and get rid of the Canadian Wheat Board?
Well, they're extraordinarily anti-democratic and also unconstitutional, as now three different judges have asserted. Well, when he first took office, or shortly after he took office, he fired the president of the Wheat Board, Adrian Meisner. He fired or removed all the government-appointed board members. There are... There's 15 board members, and the federal government appoints five, and one, of course, is made the chief executive officer, and then the ten elected directors are elected by the farmers. Well, in the very first director election to occur right after Harper became prime minister, the government decertified almost 40% of the names on the producer voting list while the voting was going on. And, of course, they targeted people, smaller farmers, who they knew would probably be more intense supporters of the Wheat Board. The bigger, you know, sort of corporate farmers are the ones that are sort of leading the charge for so-called choice. So that was one blow that he did. And then subsequently, in July... In 2007, they held a completely bogus plebiscite on removing barley from the Wheat Board, in which they inserted a misleading question which told farmers that they could have the choice of marketing their barley either through the board or privately, which got, you know, peeled enough farmers away from supporting the board that the government was able to add their numbers to the relatively small number of people who wanted to end the board monopoly in total in order to claim that it had a victory. Well, the Friends of the Canadian Wheat Board, which is a group of farmers that's been established to fight for the board, went to court and they won. They won that the fact that the government first could not abolish the compulsory marketing of barley unless they brought legislation through Parliament, which they knew they couldn't do because it would... it would be defeated in the House. So the government tried to do it by regulation, and that was also found unconstitutional. You can't do, you're required to change it by legislation, and therefore you can't do it by regulation. And then, in a more recent thing, the government it's just about to go to court again. It gave a lot of the conservative candidates in this fall's federal election access to privileged board information, that is the names of members of the names of farmers with wheat board permits, and the conservatives were able to bombard these farmers with anti-wheat board information at the height of another director's election, which was going on this fall. And then finally, of course, at the beginning, at the very outset, at the same time that they fired Adrian Meisner, the Harper government brought in a so-called gag order in which they prohibited the farmer-elected directors and all members of all members of staff of Wheat Board, the entire institution was told that it could never do anything to support the monopoly publicly, that it couldn't campaign for it, and that the farmer-elected directors were prohibited from campaigning for pro-board farmers in the last two elections. Now, this, too, was struck down in court as unconstitutional. I mean, people have the freedom of speech. And it was interesting, at the time that it was struck down, Mr. Harper was in Saskatoon, this was last summer, and he said that he vowed to anyone standing in his way about getting rid of the Wheat Board is going to get walked over.
So despite this series of very undemocratic actions and the court decisions and Harper's threat, as you mentioned, to still squelch anybody who opposes his objective, the farmers recently did elect a new board of directors. And were they what Harper wanted?
No, as a matter of fact, you know, the balance has never changed. There's been two elections because the electors are, or the board, half of the board goes before the its electorate every 2 years. There are currently 8 pro-monopoly directors and only 2 that are opposed, and that in the most recent election, 4 of the 5 most of them were just re-elected. The support for the board remains very strong. It's 80% if you look solely at the people that they are electing. And this is after twice the government has tried to tamper with the number of people who have permit books, you know.
So the farmers remain resolute in maintaining the board. Does that mean that the board is now secured?
No, not at all. I mean, there's absolutely nobody has any doubt that if Harper gets a majority, he will move very quickly to bring forth the legislation and destroy the wheat board.
And does the WTO have any role to play in the fate of the Canadian wheat board?
Well, yes, because as things now stand, the Agricultural Committee of the Wheat Board has moved to just outlaw the board, just make it, you know, illegal under WTO rules.
And would that be at the initiative of the Canadian government asking them to do that?
Well, no one knows for sure because, as a matter of fact, Canada doesn't even have a seat on this particular WTO committee. It's run by, ironically, a New Zealander who has moved to save the only other producer monopoly-controlled board that operates in the world now because the former Australian government abolished the Australian Wheat Board before it left office. There's a marketing board for kiwi fruit in New Zealand, and this particular individual who chairs this WTO committee has made sure that his removal of the right of the Canadian Wheat Board to exist does not affect the kiwi board in New Zealand in his own country.
So he's prepared to say what's good for me can be bad for you.
That's right. Absolutely.
What would you say is then does the fate of the wheat board depend on Harper remaining either minority or out of government, that the other parties, the other 3 parties in Parliament would vigorously defend them and the maintenance of the Canadian wheat board?
Oh, yes. Well, all the indications are that that's the case. And I don't think that will change because of the change in the Liberal leadership. I have no doubt that Ignatieff will support the wheat board. And you know, the Bloc is firmly behind it because the Bloc quite rightly perceives that if the wheat board goes, well, then despite Harper's protests, supply management in dairy and poultry will also go, which is very, very popular in Quebec and also in Ontario.
Well, thank you for making clear something that is often muddled in media reporting. I really appreciate that.
Well, you're very welcome. Yes, it's unfortunate. I think a lot of Central Canadian journalists have no idea about the wheat board at all, and they've bought this line that it's sort of a holdover from, you know, Soviet-style command economics.
Well, good luck to you, and thanks for your writing.
You're very welcome.
I've been speaking with Frances Russell. She's a freelance journalist located in Winnipeg, and she writes for the Winnipeg Free Press.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. A thanks to Vancouver Co-op Radio's Red Eye for that last segment. Today's episode has been archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the August 13th, 2009 episode. And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio show is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.